of the Remember We Deal With Alcohol group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Chuck. I'm an alcoholic and tonight's secretary. Good evening. Our speaker this evening is Gene. Hi, Gene. Let's open the meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. And I have asked Walt to read the 12 traditions. I'll turn the meeting over to tonight's speaker, Gene.
Good evening. I'm Gene, alcoholic. Glad to be here tonight. I want to welcome anybody that's new. Chuck called me yesterday, and I didn't have anything really planned, so I'll try and take you on a journey through my life, how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and what happened after I got here. I was born in 1935. I'm 70 years old. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous January 20th, 1983 for good and all. I'm a Texas boy. I got born in Texas. I was the only child in a small farming community about 45 miles northeast of Dallas. I never had looked at my life until I wrote my fourth and took my fifth. I never really sat down and I looked at it, and one of the things that bewildered me is how could I lived a kind of a life of Jack Armstrong, all-American boy. I wasn't a cradle alcoholic. I probably didn't drink hard liquor until I was 20. I was in college. How in the world could I end up in an organization like this in 1983? After I had done and accomplished so many things. Being an only child, my parents had tried to have children for a long time. They were thinking about adopting, and all of a sudden here I appeared, and I was the light of their life. My life really started blooming when I was about 6-7 years old, and my mother wanted to teach me tap dancing. Immediately at 8 or 9, I went into voice lessons. I had an aunt, opera singer, and she taught me voice lessons. And by the time I was 10, 11, and 12, I was in a choir, like the Vienna Boys Choir. It was in Dallas, and we traveled all over the United States. The only thing that when I was looking back on it, I never wanted to be in a choir, you know, but my mother did. And my mother sort of lived through this experience. It was unchanged voices, and I'll never forget it. We went down to audition, and I had practiced my song with my aunt, and we did all this, and all they did was do scales, you know. About 500 children there, 500 little boys, and that's all they did. And I made the second increment, and I came back, and I made the choir. I was in it for about 2.5 years, and we traveled. By the time I was 12 years old, I'd been in 38 states, and I'd been all over the United States. And we had to do our schoolwork while we were gone. We'd leave in the middle of school year, 6 weeks, scenic cruiser bus, and off we'd go. When I was turning about 14, my dad explained to me that the singing and the voice lessons were all over, and it's time to play football. In Texas, football is pretty important, and my dad was pretty serious about that. I was rewarded. I made All-State. I made a lot of touchdowns. He also informed me when I went into high school that I would be valedictorian, and he didn't ask me if I wanted to be valedictorian. So you really didn't have any trouble getting a college scholarship if you were valedictorian and football and made lots of touchdowns and ran fast. And I didn't have a choice when I went to college. My dad informed me that I wanted to go to Southern Methodist University in Dallas because that's where all the beautiful women were, and he sent me to Texas A&M. That's where we marched around in uniforms, and there wasn't any females, and I stayed there 1 year, and I transferred over to where I graduated from. I went to a smaller college, and my lady friend, who I later married, was there, and I did quite well. I got a scholarship. I went in and told a coach I had played freshman ball in A&M, and he could look at me for 4 or 5 days. If you want to give me a scholarship, then I'd play, but if otherwise, I wasn't going to stay out and waste my time or his time. And I did quite well. I graduated from college and went to Dallas and became a coach, and thought I'd I got my commission in college, ROTC, and I was commissioned an officer. And they told me I wouldn't be called up because I wasn't a pilot, and they wouldn't call me up for 2 or 3 years. And within 3 months, I got my greetings, and in January of 1958, I entered the Air Force. And they whisked me off to Cheyenne, Wyoming to go to school. What a wonderful place to go to in the middle of the winter. I'd never seen so much snow in my whole life. And that started my Air Force career. I went remote on my first duty assignment. I was in the personnel office, and they said I was going to Hawaii, and they wanted to know how I was going to travel. And I said, well, I guess you go to, I guess you fly. You're in the Air Force. You fly to wherever you're going. They said, well, you can put land transportation. And I said, what in the world is that? He said, well, you can go by boat. And I went on the Matsonia, and it was sort of a real experience. That was kind of a honeymoon for my wife and I, and we went to Hawaii. When I got to Hawaii, I had a responsible job. I was a lieutenant, second lieutenant, and immediately I got back into sports again because they had they wanted people to help coach Pop Warner football. And immediately I jumped in with a couple other lieutenants who had played college ball. And we had 10, 11, 12-year-olds, and they had never played. And that's where I met my first general, really good. And we hit it off. And every time I went over to his house, he served cocktails. He liked to drink. And it seemed like to me everybody in the Air Force liked to drink, so I began to drink. And I liked it. I really liked it. It kind of relaxed me, and I could dialogue with them, and et cetera. And our first year of coaching this on the Hickam Air Force Base, we lost every game. We didn't do well. And the next year, we won the championship. That's the first time I learned that at that age, Asian, Hawaiian little boys are a lot more coordinated than Caucasian little boys. I mean, more coordinated, faster, and etc. So we had to work harder. I had two sons, and one was born in Hawaii, and one was born in San Antonio, Texas. And I traveled around, and I like to refer to myself as a professional alcoholic, because I didn't drink in the morning, and I wouldn't really, I might get really sloshed on a Friday night, but I didn't just drink all day. I didn't drink. I drank at happy hours, which was at the officers' club, and that's where I learned to partake of all the alcohol. The Air Force, I went up to the chain of command, and I got my promotions, and I got into, I went to San Antonio, and I was an instructor down there for pre-commissioning training. I'd been reassigned to New Jersey, and I'd only been there 6 months. And because of my background and education courses and et cetera, they brought me down there to teach young college graduates how to be an officer in 4 months. And that was quite an athletic experience. And I enjoyed it. We had a class every 4 months, and they were all college grads. And my drinking continued to pick up. I had quite a good capacity, you know, at that time. I was in my late 20s, and I liked scotch, and I loved officers' clubs because we would sit there and discuss the world and all our problems during the day. Next thing in my life, I was in Southern California, and I was in the Inspector General, and during that tenure, we traveled everywhere and looked at what people were, how they were making problems or having problems or concerns. And in a 12-month period, I was probably on the road traveling 8 months out of 12. And my marriage had become fragile at that time, primarily over drinking. We got along in the other areas, but by this time, having drank quite a few years, my capacity for alcohol was beginning to slacken, and the only one who didn't know that I couldn't drink as much was me, you know. I just kept drinking normally. I got back from Germany on a Friday night, and we had traveled all day airborne, and I went home, and nobody was home. My two sons were gone, my wife, and I hadn't been home more than 10 minutes, and somebody knocked on the door, and he said, nothing personal in this, I have to deliver these papers to you, and I didn't know what the hell he was talking about, you know, and it was divorce papers, and that really upset me. Considerably. So I had a few drinks, and I wondered where she could have taken my two sons and gone. And I finally figured out in my master planning brain that she probably went to Palm Springs. So I loaded a 12-gauge shotgun and put it in the back end of the car and headed for Palm Springs. It took me about 5 hours to find her, and she was terrified when she saw me walking toward the swimming pool. I didn't have the shotgun out, but I was not happy, joyous, and free over any of this. And all I can share with you over that is it was a very terrible and complicated and tragic divorce. I was telling my lady Pat, I've been divorced a good number of years, and she continues to receive 42% of my military retirement. And that's been 20 plus years, and she's been remarried twice. So if you're thinking about a divorce and you're married over 10 years, you could kind of just bend over and kiss it goodbye as far as your assets are concerned. I arrived up here in the Bay Area in 1976. I got reassigned, and I was still going through the divorce, and they were living down in Southern California. And I was assigned over here to the Blue Building, satellite control facility, and I was the director of contracts over there. We had about an $800 million budget annual, and I was in charge of that and had to negotiate with contractors and fly back and forth to Pentagon and with our general and brief him on cost overruns and all this other stuff. My drinking at that point had really, when I was going through the divorce, it just increased, you know. Every night seemed like I'd go alone to a local pub around here, or they had a small officers club over there, and I'd drink there. I met this charming lady about 2 years after the divorce. I met her in Southern California, and she called me up one day, and she says, I'm coming up. And I said, oh, you are? And I said, she said, yeah, I want to be with you. And she moved up here, and we got married about a year and a half later for my second marriage. And her name was Lee, and she was from Canada, and she was the love of my life. She went through the last phases of dark, dark drinking. 1981, my drinking had really gotten out of control. I was working in Palo Alto. I'd retired from the Air Force. I had taken a job up at Electric Power Research. It was a research firm for all the electric industries throughout America, and I was doing the absolutely same thing I did in the Air Force. And I was just a little tired, and I one morning about 10:30, I told my boss I had to go to the hospital, and I went to El Camino Emergency Ward, and I sat in a little room with a nurse, and she was trying to find out what was wrong with me, and all I could tell her was I was just a bit tired. I couldn't tell her I had a drinking problem. I just kept telling her quietly with my head down looking at the floor that I was tired. And so they put me inside the lockdown part of El Camino Hospital, and I didn't like that at all because they didn't understand I was a colonel and I had a master's degree. And I had done all these things, and I'd be happy to show them my resume if they just asked. By the next morning, they had verified that I had insurance, and that's what they were really interested in. And then they found a place up in Hayward called Starting Point. I think it was Hayward. It may have been Fremont. But anyway, I was whisked off up to a recovery program, and I didn't even get to go home and get my shaving gear or change of clothes or anything. And I think they were wise about that because I probably would not have proceeded up there by myself. Never forget the first day I got there, I was interviewed by my counselor, a caseworker, I think their official call. He was asking me all the questions, and I'd fill out tons of forms and all that other stuff. And I wanted to know what qualified him to be my counselor. And that kind of put him back, and I wanted to see his resume, you know. I'm only sharing that because that was my general attitude about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have the foggiest idea how you could help me. And as I looked around the rooms when I first got here, I certainly didn't belong here. I had no business here. I hadn't done all the accomplishments of my life and ended up here in this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. The lady in charge of the program was non-alcoholic. She had a PhD from University of Michigan, and she and I we conversed quite a bit. I gave her one suggestion. I mean, I'm trying to get some smiles or laughter out of it. But every morning, right after breakfast, we read in groups. We read the big book, and you know, you'd read a page or I'd read a page, and I went to her after I'd been there about a week, and I said, "Could I make a suggestion?" And she said, "Absolutely." I said, "Well, could we divide the groups into those that can read and those that can't read?" Because I read pretty fast, and that was part of my training, and I would read probably half a chapter by the time we finished three paragraphs, and it was really irritating the hell out of me when it was costing $12,000. You know, I didn't. It cost me $2,000, but it cost my insurance $10,000, and that program, 30 days of it, and then we had the graduation ceremony and photos and all this. Press from CBS, ABC News came to see us, and I'm joking. And they passed out 30-day medallions, and I didn't get one. And that was my last conversation with the director. I went to her, and I said, you do realize I didn't get a medallion? And she said, yes, we understand. Well, it was the opinion of the faculty that you weren't going to stay sober. And I said, well, that's wonderful. I appreciate that. And we all packed up our little duffel bags, and we were leaving, and there were four guys that worked at Oakland Airport, mechanics on airliners, and they wanted me to go join them one block away to have a couple of beers, you know, and down they went, and I had such a resentment about no metal chip, I didn't go with them. So I stayed sober. I didn't stay sober. I stayed dry for 6 months, 2 weeks, and 3 days. And then one night I was out with my wife, and she was non-alcoholic, and she ordered a glass of white wine with dinner, and I said, ma'am, make that two. And she looked at me very strangely and said, I don't think you should have that glass of wine. And I told the waitress, did you hear me, ma'am? Two glasses of white wine. And I remember walking out of the restaurant, and I took a deep breath, kind of like, I can drink again. And it was probably 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and I was back on my liquor of my choice, which was scotch, double scotches, and I was gone, and I was gone for 18 months. And when I came back in to Alcoholics Anonymous, January of 83, I was broken and defeated. I had been beaten into a sense of reasonableness, and I want to share with you, if you happen to be like I was and don't have a desire, this thing is not going to work. I learned that through the years. I had a real dear friend that went back out, and I chased him all over the Santa Clara Valley trying to get him back into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I never got him back. He died behind a liquor store in 1999. And that taught me a lot about what alcohol can do to you. And I got here. Third meeting I went to was at Alano East. The greeter at the door happened to be my bartender, James Posniak, and that was very difficult. I stopped, and he stared at me, and I can still visualize him standing there, and he said, what the hell are you doing here? It was a Saturday night speaker meeting in Alano East, and I was frozen, and I couldn't talk, and he came over and put his arms around me and said, you don't have to drink anymore if you don't want to. And I started crying, and he said, knock that shit off. And he said, let's go meet some guys. And he hauled me in the meeting hall and introduced me to some guys that helped me stay sober. Paz and I, Paz was unique and priceless, and he was no saint. He sponsored lots of people, lots of men, and after about 6 months, he and I had a confrontation at 400 West Campbell, which was my home meeting. We just had a few words, and we divided, and I remember that night very well. I went over and asked my sponsor, who's here tonight, to be my sponsor, and he corrected me and told me I had a sponsor, and I said, no, I don't have a sponsor anymore, and since you sponsor him, I want you as my sponsor, because I don't ever want to explain to anybody anything about him ever again, and that's where my sponsor took me through the rest of the steps. I had gone through 1, 2, 3 with Pause, and as I look back over the years, he saved my life. God put him in my life that night, and he broke my denial. Very, very difficult to argue and debate with your bartender. especially when I walked in the bar where he was working, and he would see me come in, and he would pour me a double and a splash of water and just set it up on the bar, and I'd get down and I'd act like I didn't even know he did it, you know, and then I'd say, oh, is that mine? And he'd nod at me, and I tipped him well. I mean, I liked service. I didn't like to order anything. That's the kind of alcoholic I was. And I never drank at a bar but once that measured drinks. I went to bar to drink alcohol. And if I went in and they measured it, that was the last time I ever went in there. I wanted them to pour it, you know, freely, because that was my drug of choice. One of my dear friends was a barber, and he was my golfing partner, and he and I were very effective in winning money. And he sold other substances in his barbershop. And he continually tried to get me to partake of them, and I wouldn't do it. And I could go into a long story. It wasn't that I didn't have opportunity to use substances other than alcohol. I just didn't elect to do it. And mainly because of my, my years in the military, and it was illegal, and I had all kinds of opportunities to bring it into the country on airplanes that were, you know, weren't even looked at by customs. Some people did that and regretted it the rest of their life when they got caught. That kind of gets me to the start of my recovery, and I was trying to get into Big Book. That's where the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is. And first thing I thought about was what I had to do, and I hated it. And it was on page 25 of the Big Book, and it says, there is a solution. And almost none of us like this self-searching. And when I got here, my sponsor introduced me to that, and he said, none of us liked it. So if you don't like it, that's good. I thought that was the easiest, clearest explanation I'd ever heard about the rest of the paragraph. And this thing was written a long, long time ago. The leveling of our pride. That was my number one character defect, false pride. I was either better than or worse than. I was never equal to anybody. I got a master's degree and I went to night school. I mean, everybody seemed to want a master's degree, and that would give me more brownie points on my resume. So I went at night to get that. And anytime in my military career, if I didn't know something, I researched it and I studied it, or I took a course in it, or whatever the heck I had to do. I went to some very nice schools and away. But the leveling of our pride, and the simplest form that I can share with you, is the admission that I had lost my ability to control my drinking, and I was an alcoholic. And I didn't really honestly understand when I got here that if I took one drink, then I would have two drinks. And if I had two drinks, anything was possible. I might go directly home and pass a Boardwalk in Park Place, or I might get home at 11:30 or 12 o'clock at night, or one Friday night, we had finished playing golf and played our dice game, and we're sitting there about 9 o'clock at night, maybe 8 o'clock is when the conversation came up, and one of my drinking partners, who was a United Airlines pilot, he said, why don't we go play the country club in Honolulu in the morning? And, you know, this group that we played, and we said, well, we got no clothes, and all we need is the golf clubs. He said, there's a we'll catch a late flight. And we said, God, that's cost a lot. And he said, no, I got all kinds of, I'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. And I called my wife from Honolulu next morning. We were at the golf course fixing to tee off. And she was worried because I didn't get home that night. That was just a spur of the moment of my insanity. And there we are in Honolulu at this private country club that he belonged to, and playing golf. And we never thought anything about it, you know. Had a few Bloody Marys and teed her up. We came home Sunday night, and that didn't go over well with my wife. The confession of our shortcomings, which the process requires for its consummation, and I really didn't have any burning desire to take responsibility for my actions with my loved ones, which were my two sons and my wife that got the heat of my last 3.5 years of insanity. And to this day, I still have a slight resentment about paying my mother and my children. My dear Italian friend, and I played a game of golf with some retired soprano types. And at the end of the golf round, we were drinking Cokes and they were drinking Scotch. And somehow my friend told the soprano two guys about me having to financially support my ex-wife, and they didn't find that very nice, very anything. And the one guy took out his case, a little gold case, and took a card out and wrote a number on the back and gave it to my friend, and I didn't know what the hell it was all about. Later I found out that was a number that you call and you take care of your problems. You know, you just make them go away. And he said, just tell them that you're a referral from me and the problem will disappear. And the only thing that I got involved in was I had to hire a private detective and followed her on her way to work down in Southern California. And he sent me a roadmap, and I had to furnish that because that was part of the plan of eliminating her from Earth. And I would have voted myself a considerable pay raise, you know. That's how half measures availed us nothing, you know. And honesty prevailed, and I didn't go through with it. But the program of staying sober, I guess I discovered that alcohol was but a symptom of my problem. My problem was me and my various underlying traits. And I had learned in the Air Force, I mean, I was an individual, and I've done it several times while I've been in the program. You really did not want me as an enemy. I mean, if you really wanted an enemy, make me one, because I had a long memory, and I would certainly spend a lot of time on other than worthy goals of helping you. And my sponsor, Jack over there, he and I had long discussions over that. Another little paragraph here says, if you're seriously alcoholic as we are, we believe there's no middle of the road solution. And I've discovered over the years, the middle of the road is, you're on one side one day and skip over to the other side and you're just kind of going back and forth. And you can't practice rigorous honesty at AA meetings and give real spiritual little talks and work with other people. I didn't particularly want to sponsor anybody, and my sponsor shared with me on my first birthday that I would not stay sober unless I worked with other alcoholics. He said, there's no possibility that you'd ever stay sober. He said, number one, you're not grateful for anything. And the one thing that is a feedback from working with another alcoholic is a little bit of gratitude. And you have no opportunity to run your mind like a computer screen when you're working with another man and you're in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and you're trying to share with him your experience, strength, and hope. I like this paragraph. The things that I'm sharing with the big book is just simply my observations as I went through the steps. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. Pozniak would not let me go to the first step until I went through that with him. And he knew that I was intellectually fairly bright and I was a fairly quick learner. And he knew that I would just play games with, I'm an alcoholic and powerless to alcohol, and my life's unmanageable. Conceding to your innermost self. He put me in the floor of his apartment. He told me to lay down on the floor, and I laid down, and then he put his foot on my back, and I didn't know what the hell he was doing, and he put one foot on my hips here, and then he grabbed my right arm, and he was jerking on it, and it was hurting really bad. And he says, do you concede? And I said, what? And he says, and he jerked on it, and I said, you're hurting me. And he kept jerking on it till I said, in Texas they say calf rope. And I just said, I give up. I can't, you know. And that's what conceding to your innermost self meant to me. that if I went back and played around with alcohol again, it would kick my butt again. No doubt about it. And after we went through that, I could move on to the first step. Powerless over alcohol, my life was unmanageable. I had a lot of pain with the part that life is unmanageable. And that was my denial that I didn't want to look at myself and the wreckage I had scattered around. And over the years, I've discovered a common trait. I think alcoholics in general are far more alike in the areas of feelings and emotions than we're different. And I don't think that makes it much difference whether you're male or female. And I think I've learned through the years, I think the female alcoholic is stronger than the male. I think we're just kind of pipsqueaks when we arrive here. I don't think we really want to take a look at ourselves at all. And my friend up here, that he and I got about the same vintage, and the only reason he came tonight was so he'd keep me honest. Then the sentence where it says the delusion that we're like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed, because I'm not like my fellows, you know. I'm really not. I lost my ability to control my drinking. It had wrecked my life. I was dying of alcoholism, and the only one that didn't know it was me, which is really sad. I remember it didn't dawn on me probably for a couple of years when I was here. The night that I called Alcoholics Anonymous, I was home and my wife had moved out. We had been going to work Monday morning. We got in separate cars and she went off her way and I went off mine. And when I got home that night, about 6 o'clock at home, we lived down in Chateau La Salle on Monterey Road. There was nothing left. There was 3 glasses. 3 dishes, television, a bed, and she'd moved everything out. She called me about 8 o'clock, and I'd had a couple of drinks, and she said, you know, I love you. I love you very much, but I just can't live with you anymore. And I drank for another couple of days, and then I was standing there alone in my home, and I fell down on one knee. And I said, God, I can't drink anymore. That's all I said was, God, I can't drink anymore. I didn't get on 2 knees. I was incapable of doing that. But I got on 1 knee, and God knew I was honest about that for the first time. Because I believe he knows our innermost thoughts. I just know he knows. And that's when I picked up the phone, called Alcoholics Anonymous, and went to my first really meeting since I'd gotten out of Starting Point. And then somebody suggested that I go to Saturday Night, Alano East, or Alano Club of San Jose now, and I went over there and ran into my bartender who had been in the program for some time. And that changed my life. Pat and I we went to Canada to the 70th anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was unbelievable. That was the third one I had gone to. I don't know what it is about the conventions, except that you can just feel. I never did haven't seen the actual attendance there, but that first opening meeting, I don't know, there were probably 50,000 there. But at the end of the Lord's Prayer, at the end of the opening night, this lady singer came out and sang Amazing Grace, How Sweet Thou Art to Save a Wretch Like Me. And the whole audience joined in with her a little bit later. And that should be our theme song, if we have a theme song. I was in a church the other day and picked up a hymnal and read the words. They're very specific and could apply to any alcoholic. I'm looking for this little thing I did the other day. The I can't find it. You know, when you want to look for something in the big book, you know exactly where it is, but you can't find it. That's just happened to me, so I won't share that with you. If you're new, I want to welcome you. I want to share with you that evidence is here in this room that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works. I remember one night I had maybe 4 or 5 years, and I was at a meeting, and the topic was evidence. And I said, "Oh my God, what's this guy going to talk about?" And he said, "Look around the room, and you'll see all these people that don't drink anymore." And I thought, "God, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good observation. We don't drink anymore. And how do we do it? We do it one day at a time." When I first got here, I had to go to a meeting in the morning on the way to work, and I'd stop by 7:30 and stay about 20 minutes, and then I had to be at work at 8:30, and this was about 7:40, and I knew I wasn't going to drink till noon. Then I'd go to a noon meeting, and I started brown bagging it, and I'd stay there about 40 minutes because I had to be back at work. And then in the evening, I was directed to go to men's meetings. I was not allowed to go to mixed meetings till I had 90 days. I like the female gender all over the world, and I used to do my southern accent better about saying Dallas, you know. When you're in London and you say Dallas, they just giggle really hard. Or you go over to Germany and you say Dallas. Where are you from? Dallas. Oh, and I just enjoyed the heck out of that. And I learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous that wasn't very honest when you're married and you play around silly games. I played a silly game in Los Gatos. I was at a Los Gatos meeting one night, and the lady got up, and she was going through a divorce, and she was very attractive. And after the meeting was over, I went up and I said, "Ma'am, you saved my life tonight." She was, you know, I said, I was driving around in my car, and I was thinking about having a drink, and I just passed a bar, and I called central office, and they told me this, and this was only 2 blocks away, and I come in here, and you just said, and I told her what she said, and she smiled, and I said, "Would you like to go have some coffee or apple pie or something?" And I did that several weeks in a row, and the vibrations were white, and I shared that with my sponsor, and he first question was, "Are you still married?" "Well, yeah, I'm still married, but what has that got to do with anything?" And that has something to do with your honesty as a human being, as you know. And that's the kind of guy I was. And the men and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and many of them, I think the one thing that kept me coming back was at the men's meetings, I heard these men up here, and I knew without any reservation, they were not lying to me. They were telling me the truth. They were telling me what they had to do to stay sober. And I just kept coming back, and every week they were there and they'd share. And I'm just grateful that I don't drink anymore. And have a good evening and good night. Thank you very much.